Ready, Ellie said.
Thank God, he said. I just ran out of things to do to keep from going nuts.
You got to help me spot them, she said. I'll be looking too, but I might not see one of them.
Indicating the screen, he said, That's Godzilla?
No, this is the game board that Godzilla and I are both going to play with. It's a grid of the 5 acres immediately around the house and barn. Each of these tiny grid blocks is 6 meters on a side. I just hope to God my entry data, those property maps and county records, were accurate enough. I know they're not dead on, not by a long shot, but let's pray they're close. See this green shape? That's the house. See this? The barn. Here are the stables down toward the end of the driveway. This blinking dot, that's us. See this line? That's the county road where we want to be.
Is this based on one of the video games you invented?
No, this is nasty reality, she said. And whatever happens, Spencer, I love you. I can't imagine anything better than spending the rest of my life with you. I just hope it's going to be more than 5 minutes.
He had started to put the truck in gear. Her frank expression of her feelings made him hesitate because he wanted to kiss her now, here, for the first time, in case it was the last time, too. Then he froze and stared at her in amazement as comprehension came. Godzilla's looking straight down at us right now, isn't he?
Yeah.
It's a satellite? And you've hijacked it?
Been saving these codes for a day when I was in a really tight corner, no other way out, because I'll never get a chance to use them again. When we're out of here, when I let go of Godzilla, they'll shut it down and reprogram.
What does it do besides look down?
Remember the movies?
Godzilla movies?
His white-hot, glowing breath?
You're making this up.
He had halitosis that melted tanks.
Oh, my God.
Now or never, she said.
Now, he said, putting the truck into reverse, wanting to get it over with before he had any more time to think about it. He switched on the headlights, backed away from the barn, and headed around the building, retracing the route that they had taken from the county road.
Not too fast, she said. It'll pay to tiptoe out of here, believe me.
Spencer let up on the accelerator. Drifting along now, easing past the front of the barn, the other branch of the driveway over there, the backyard to the right, the swimming pool. A brilliant white searchlight fixed them from an open second-floor window of the house 60 yards to their right and 40 yards ahead. Spencer was blinded when he looked in that direction, and he could not see whether there were sharpshooters with rifles at any of the other windows. Ellie's fingers rattled the keys. He glanced over and saw a yellow indicator line on the display screen. It represented a swath about 2 meters wide and 24 meters long between them and the house. Ellie pressed enter.
Squint, she said,
and in the same moment Spencer shouted, Rocky, down! Out of the stars came a blue-white incandescence. It was not as fierce as he had expected, marginally brighter than the spotlight from the house, but it was infinitely stranger than anything he had ever seen above ground. The beam was crisply defined along the edges, and it seemed not to be radiating light as much as containing it, holding an atomic fire within a skin as thin as the surface tension on a pond. A bone-vibrating hum accompanied it like electronic feedback from huge stadium speakers and a sudden turbulence of air. As the light moved on a course that Ellie had laid out for it, 2 meters wide, 24 meters long, between them and the house, but approaching neither, a roar arose similar to the subterranean grumble of the few grinding-type earthquakes that Spencer had ridden out over the years, although this was far louder. The earth shook hard enough to rock the truck. In that 2-meter-wide swath, the snow and the ground beneath it leaped into flames, turned molten in an instant to what depth he didn't know. The beam moved along, and the center of a big sycamore vanished in a flash. It didn't merely burst into flame, but disappeared as if it had never existed. The tree was instantly converted into light and into heat that was detectable even inside the truck with the windows closed almost 30 yards from the beam itself. Numerous splintered branches, which had hung beyond the sharply defined edge of the beam, fell to the ground on both sides of the light, and they were on fire at the points of severance. The blue-white blade burned past the pickup, across the backyard, diagonally between them and the house, across one edge of the patio, vaporizing concrete, all the way to the edge of the path that Ellie had set it upon, and then it winked out. A 2-meter-wide, 24-meter length of earth glowed white-hot, boiling like a lava flow at its freshest on the high slopes of a volcano. The magma churned brightly in the trench that contained it, bubbling and popping and spitting showers of red and white sparks into the air, casting a glow that reached even to the truck and coloring the surviving snow red-orange. During the event, if they had not been too stunned to speak, they would have had to shout at each other to be heard. Now, the silence seemed as profound as that in the vacuum of deep space. At the house, the agency men switched off the searchlight. "Keep moving," Ellie said urgently. Spencer hadn't realized that he'd braked to a complete stop. They drifted forward again, easy, moving cautiously through the lion's den, easy. He risked a little more speed than before because the lions had to be scared shitless right now.
"God bless America," Spencer said shakily.
"Oh, Godzilla isn't one of ours."
"It isn't?"
"Japanese."
"The Japanese have a death ray satellite?"
"Enhanced laser technology, and they have 8 satellites in the system."
"I thought they were busy making better televisions."
She was working diligently on the keyboard again, getting ready for the worst. "Damn it, my right hand's cramping." He saw that she had targeted the house. She said, "The U.S. has something similar, but I don't have any codes that'll get me into our system. The fools on our side call it the Hyperspace Hammer, which has nothing to do with what it is. It's just a name they liked from a video game."
"You invent the game?"
"Actually, yes."
"They make an amusement park ride out of it?"
"Yes."
"I saw one."
Moving past the house now, not even looking up at the windows, not tempting fate.
"You can commandeer a secret Japanese defense satellite?"
"Through the DOD, she said.
"Department of Defense?"
"The Japanese don't know it, but the DOD can grab Godzilla's brain anytime they want. I'm just using the doorways that the DOD has already installed." He remembered something that she had said in the desert only that morning when he had expressed surprise about the possibility of satellite surveillance. He quoted it back to her.
"You'd be surprised what's up there." "Surprised" is one word.
"The Israelis have their own system."
"The Israelis?"
"Yeah, little Israel. They worry me less than anyone else who's got it. Chinese, think about that. Maybe the French. No more jokes about Paris cab drivers. God knows who else has it." They were almost past the house. A small round hole was punched through the side window behind Ellie, even as the sound of the shot cracked the night, and Spencer felt the round thud into the back of his seat. The velocity of the bullet was so great that the tempered glass crazed slightly but did not collapse inward. Thank God, Rocky was barking energetically instead of squealing in agony. "Stupid bastards," Ellie said as she pressed enter again. Out of airless space, a lambent column of blue-white light shot down into the 2-story Victorian farmhouse, instantly vaporizing a core 2 meters in diameter. The rest of the structure exploded. Flames filled the night. If anyone was left alive in that crumbling house, they would have to get out too fast to worry about holding onto their weapons and taking additional pot shots at the pickup. Ellie was shaken. "I couldn't risk them hitting the uplink behind us. If that goes, we're in deep trouble."
"The Russians have this?"
"This and weirder stuff."
"Weirder stuff?"
"That's why most everyone else is desperate to get their version of Godzilla. Zhirinovsky, heard of him?"
"Russian politician."
Bending her head again to the VDT, entering new instructions, she said, "Him and the people associated with him, the whole network of them, even after he's gone, they're old-fashioned communists who want to rule the world. Except this time, they're actually willing to blow it up if they don't get their way. No more graceful defeats. And even if someone's smart enough to wipe out the Zhirinovsky faction, there's always some new power freak somewhere calling himself a politician." 40 yards ahead, on the right, a Ford Bronco erupted from concealment in a stand of trees and bushes. It pulled across the driveway, blocking their escape. Spencer halted the pickup. Though the driver of the Bronco stayed behind the wheel, 2 men with high-power rifles jumped out of the back and dropped into sharpshooter positions. They raised their weapons. "Down," Spencer said, and pushed Ellie's head below window level, even as he slid down in his seat.
"They aren't," she said in disbelief.
"They are."
"Blocking the driveway?"
2 sharpshooters and a Bronco.
"Haven't they been paying attention?"
"Stay down, Rocky," he said. The dog was standing again with his forepaws on the front seat, bobbing his head excitedly.
"Rocky, down," Spencer said fiercely.
The dog whimpered as though his feelings had been hurt, but he dropped to the floor in back. Ellie said,
"How far are they?"
Spencer risked a quick peek, slid down again, and a bullet rang off the window post without shattering the windshield.
"I'd say 40 yards,
she typed. On the screen appeared a yellow line to the right of the driveway. It was 12 meters long, angling over an open field toward the Bronco, but it stopped a meter or two from the edge of the pavement. "Don't want to score the driveway," she said. "Tires would dissolve when we tried to get across the molten ground." "Can I press enter?" he asked. "Be my guest." He pressed it and sat up, squinting, as the breath of Godzilla streamed down through the night again, scoring the land. The ground shook, and an apocalyptic thunder rose under them as if the planet was coming apart. The night air hummed deafeningly, and the merciless beam dazzled along the course that she'd assigned to it. Before Godzilla had turned the earth into white-hot sludge along even half those 12 meters, the pair of sharpshooters dropped their weapons and leaped for the vehicle behind them. As they hung on to the sides of the Bronco, the driver careened off the blacktop, churned across a frozen field beyond, smashed through a whiteboard fence, crossed a paddock, rammed through another fence, and passed the first of the stables. When Godzilla stopped short of the driveway and the night was suddenly dark and quiet again, the Bronco was still going, fast dwindling into the gloom, as though the driver might head overland until he ran out of gasoline. Spencer drove to the county road. He stopped and looked both ways. No traffic. He turned right toward Denver. For a few miles, neither of them spoke. Rocky stood with his forepaws on the back of the front seat, gazing ahead at the highway. In the 2 years that Spencer had known him, the dog had never liked to look back. Ellie sat with her hand clamped to her wound. Spencer hoped that the people she knew in Denver could get her medical attention. The medications that she had finessed by computer out of various drug companies had been lost with the Range Rover. Eventually, she said, "We'd better stop in Copper Mountain, see if we can find new wheels. This truck's too recognizable." "Okay." She switched off the computer, unplugged it. The mountains were dark with evergreens and pale with snow. The moon was setting behind the truck, and the night sky ahead was ablaze with stars. Chapter 15. Eve Jammer hated Washington, D.C. in August. Actually, she hated Washington through all seasons with equal passion. Admittedly, the city was pleasant for a short while when the cherry blossoms were in bloom. During the rest of the year, it sucked. Humid, crowded, noisy, dirty, crime-ridden, full of boring, stupid, greedy politicians whose ideals were either in their pants or in their pants' pockets. It was an inconvenient place for a capital, and sometimes she dreamed about moving the government elsewhere when the time was right. Maybe to Las Vegas. As she drove through the sweltering August heat, she had the air conditioner in her Chrysler Town Car turned nearly to its highest setting with the fans on maximum blow. Freezing air blasted across her face and body and up her skirt, but she was still hot. Part of the heat, of course, had nothing to do with the day. She was so horny she could have won a head-butting duel with a ram. She hated the Chrysler almost as much as she hated Washington. With all her money and position, she ought to have been able to drive a Mercedes, if not a Rolls-Royce. But a politician's wife had to be careful of appearances, at least for a while yet. It was impolitic to drive a foreign-made car. 18 months had passed since Eve Jammer had met Roy Miro and had learned the nature of her true destiny. For 16 months she had been married to the widely admired Senator E. Jackson Haynes, who would head the party's national ticket in next year's election. That wasn't speculation, it had already been arranged, and all his rivals would screw up one way or another in the primaries, leaving him standing alone, a giant of a man on the world scene. Personally, she loathed E. Jackson Haynes and wouldn't let him touch her, except in public. Even then, there were several pages of rules that he'd been required to memorize, defining the acceptable limits relating to affectionate hugs, kisses on the cheek, and hand-holding. The recordings that she had of him in his Vegas hideaway, engaged in sex with several different little girls and boys below the age of 12, had ensured his prompt acceptance of her proposal of marriage and the strict terms of convenience under which their relationship would be conducted. Jackson didn't pout too much or too often about the arrangement. He was keen on the idea of being president, and without the library of recordings that Eve possessed, which incriminated all of his most serious political rivals, he wouldn't have had a chance in hell of getting close to the White House. For a while, she had worried that a few of the politicians and power brokers whose enmity she had earned would be too thick-headed to realize that the boxes in which she'd put them were inescapable. If they terminated her, they would all fall in the biggest, dirtiest series of political scandals in history. More than scandals, many of these servants of the people had committed outrages appalling enough to cause riots in the streets, even if federal agents were dispatched with machine guns to quell them. Some of the worst hard-asses hadn't been convinced that she'd secreted copies of her recordings all over the world, or that the contents of those laser discs were destined for the airwaves within hours of her death from multiple and, in many cases, automated sources. The last of them had come around, however, when she had accessed their home television sets through satellite and cable facilities while blocking all other customers, and had played for them one by one fragments of their recorded crimes. Sitting in their own bedrooms and dens, they had listened with astonishment, terrified that she was broadcasting those fragments to the world. Computer technology was wonderful. Many of the hard-asses had been with wives or mistresses when those unexpected, intensely personal broadcasts had appeared on their television screens. In most cases, their significant others were as guilty or as power-mad as they were themselves, and eager to keep their mouths shut. However, one influential senator and a member of the president's cabinet had been married to women who exhibited bizarre moral codes and who refused to keep secret what they had learned. Before divorce proceedings and public revelations could begin, both had been shot to death at different automatic teller machines on the same night. That tragedy resulted in the lowering of the nation's flag at all government buildings citywide for 24 hours, and in the introduction of a bill in Congress to require the posting of health warnings on all automated tellers. Eve turned the air conditioner control to the highest setting. Just thinking about those women's expressions when she'd put the gun to their heads made her hotter than ever. She was still 2 miles from Cloverfield, and the Washington traffic was terrible. She wanted to blow her horn and flip a stiff finger at some of the insufferable morons who were causing the snarls at the intersections. But she had to be discreet. The next First Lady of the United States could not be seen flipping off anyone. Besides, she had learned from Roy that anger was a weakness. Anger should be controlled and transformed into that only truly ennobling emotion, compassion. These bad drivers didn't want to tie up traffic. They were simply lacking in sufficient intellect to drive well. Their lives were probably blighted in many ways. They deserved not anger, but compassionate release to a better world, whenever that release could be privately given. She considered jotting down license numbers to make it possible to find some of these poor souls later and at her leisure give them that gift of gifts. She was in too great a hurry, however, to be as compassionate as she would have liked. She couldn't wait to get to Cloverfield and share the good news about Daddy's generosity. Through a complex chain of international trusts and corporations, her father, Thomas Summerton, First Deputy Attorney General of the United States, had transferred $300 million of his holdings to her, which provided her with as much freedom as did the laser disc recordings from 2 years in that spider-infested Vegas bunker. The smartest thing she had ever done in a life of smart moves was not to squeeze Daddy for money years ago when she'd first gotten the goods on him. She had asked instead for a job with the agency. Daddy had believed that she'd wanted the bunker job because it was so easy. Nothing to do down there but sit, read magazines, and collect $100,000 a year in salary. He'd made the mistake of thinking that she was a not-too-bright small-time hustler. Some men never seem to stop thinking with their pants long enough to get wise. Tom Summerton was one of them. Ages ago, when Eve's mother had been Daddy's mistress, he would have been wise to treat her better. But when she got pregnant and refused to abort the baby, he had dumped her. Hard. Even in those days, Daddy had been a rich young man and heir to even more. And although he hadn't achieved much political power yet, he'd had great ambition. He easily could have afforded to treat Mama well. When she threatened to go public and ruin his reputation, however, he'd sent a couple of goons to beat her up, and she'd nearly had a miscarriage. Thereafter, poor Mama had been a bitter, frightened woman until the day she died. Daddy had been thinking with his pants when he'd been stupid enough to keep a 15-year-old mistress like Mama. And later he'd been thinking with his pants pockets when he should have been thinking with his head or his heart. He was thinking with his pants again when he'd allowed Eve to seduce him, though of course he hadn't ever seen her before and hadn't known that she was his daughter. By then he had forgotten poor Mama as if she'd been a one-night stand, although he had been putting it to her for 2 years before he dumped her. And if Mama barely existed in his memory, the possibility of having fathered a child had been wiped off his mental slate completely. Eve had not simply seduced him, but had reduced him to a state of animal lust that over a period of weeks made him the easiest of marks. When she eventually suggested a little fantasy role-playing, wherein they would act like father and violated daughter in bed, he had been excited. Her pretend resistance and pitiful cries of rape excited him to new feats of endurance, preserved on high-resolution videotape, from four angles, recorded on the finest audio equipment. She'd saved some of his ejaculate in order to have a genetic match done with a sample of her own blood to convince him that she was indeed his darling child. The tape of their role-playing would unquestionably be viewed by authorities as nothing less than forcible incest. Upon being presented with that package, Daddy had for once in his life thought with his brain. He was convinced that killing her would not save him, so he had been willing to pay whatever was necessary to buy her silence. He'd been surprised and pleased when she'd asked not for any of his money, but for a secure, well-paid government job. He'd been less pleased when she'd wanted to know a lot more about the agency and the secret derring-do about which he'd bragged once or twice in bed. After a few difficult days, however, he had seen the wisdom of bringing her into the agency fold. "You're cunning, little bitch," he said when they had reached agreement. He'd put an arm around her with genuine affection. He had been disappointed after giving her the job to learn that they would not continue sleeping together, but he had gotten over that loss in time. He really had thought that cunning was the best word to describe her. Her ability to use her position in the bunker for her own ends didn't become clear to him until he learned that she had married E. Jackson Haynes after a whirlwind courtship of 2 days, and had managed to put most of the powerful politicians in the city under her thumb. Then she had gone to him to begin discussions regarding an inheritance. And Daddy had discovered that cunning might not be a sufficiently descriptive word. Now she had reached the end of the entrance drive to Cloverfield and parked at the red curb near the front door, beside a sign that said "No parking anytime." She put one of Jackson's Member of Congress cards on the dashboard, relished the icy air of the Chrysler for one more moment, then stepped out into the August heat and humidity. Cloverfield, all white columns and stately walls, was one of the finest institutions of its kind in the continental United States. A liveried doorman greeted her. The concierge at the main desk in the lounge was a distinguished-looking British gentleman named Danfield, though she didn't know if that was his first or last name. After Danfield signed her in and chatted pleasantly with her, Eve walked the familiar route through the hushed halls. Original paintings by famous American artists of previous centuries were well complemented by antique Persian runners on wine-dark mahogany floors, polished to a watery sheen. When she entered Roy's suite, she found the dear man shuffling around in his walker, getting some exercise. With the attention of the finest specialists and therapists in the world, he had regained full use of his arms. Increasingly, he seemed certain to be able to walk on his own again within a few months, though with a limp. She gave him a dry kiss on the cheek. He favored her with one even drier. "You're more beautiful every time you visit," he said. "Well, men's heads still turn," she said, "but not like they used to, not when I have to wear clothes like these." A future First Lady of the United States couldn't dress as would a former Las Vegas showgirl who'd gotten a thrill out of driving men insane. These days she even wore a bra that spread her breasts out and restrained them, to make her appear less amply endowed than she really was. She had never been a showgirl anyway, and her surname had not been Jammer, but Lincoln, as in Abraham. She had attended school in 5 different states and West Germany because her father had been a career military man who'd been transferred from base to base. She had graduated from the Sorbonne in Paris and had spent a number of years teaching poor children in the kingdom of Tonga in the South Pacific. At least, that was what every data record would reveal to even the most industrious reporter armed with the most powerful computer and the cleverest mind. She and Roy sat side by side on a settee. Pots of hot tea, an array of pastries, clotted cream, and jam had been provided on a charming little Chippendale table. While they sipped and munched, she told him about the 300 million that her father had transferred to her. Roy was so happy for her that tears came to his eyes. He was a dear man. They talked about the future. The time when they could be together again every night without any subterfuge seemed depressingly distant. E. Jackson Haines would assume the office of president on January 20th, 17 months hence. He and the vice president would be assassinated the following year, though Jackson was unaware of that detail. With the approval of constitutional scholars and the advice of the Supreme Court of the United States, both houses of Congress would take the unprecedented step of calling for a special election. Eve Marie Lincoln Haines, widow of the martyred president, would run for the office, be elected by a landslide, and begin serving her first term. "A year after that, I'll have mourned a decent length of time," she told Roy. "Don't you think a year?" "More than decent, especially as the public will love you so much and want happiness for you. And then I can marry the heroic FBI agent who tracked down and killed that escaped maniac, Stephen Ackblom."
4 years until we're together forever," Roy said. "Not so long, really. I promise you, Eve, I'll make you happy and do honor to my position as first gentleman."
"I know you will, darling," she said.
"And by then, anyone who doesn't like anything you do,
we shall treat with utmost compassion."
"Exactly."
"Now, let's not talk any more about how long we have to wait. Let's discuss more of your wonderful ideas. Let's make plans."
For a long time, they talked about uniforms for a variety of new federal organizations they wished to create, with a special focus on whether metal snaps and zippers were more exciting than traditional bone buttons.
Chapter 16. In the broiling sun, hard-bodied young men and legions of strikingly attractive women in the briefest of bikinis soaked up the rays and casually struck poses for one another. Children built sandcastles. Retirees sat under umbrellas, wearing straw hats, soaking up the shade. They were all happily oblivious of eyes in the sky and of the possibility that they could be instantaneously vaporized at the whim of politicians of various nationalities, or even by a demented genius computer hacker living in a cyberpunk fantasy in Cleveland or London or Cape Town or Pittsburgh. As he walked along the shore near the tide line with the huge hotels piled one beside the other to his right, he rubbed lightly at his face. His beard itched. He'd had it for 6 months, and it wasn't a scruffy-looking beard. On the contrary, it was soft and full, and Ellie insisted that he was even more handsome with it than without it. Nevertheless, on a hot August day in Miami Beach, it itched as if he had fleas, and he longed to be clean-shaven. Besides, he liked the appearance of his beardless face. During the 18 months since the night on which Godzilla had attacked the ranch in Vail, a superb plastic surgeon in the private pay sector of the British medical establishment had performed 3 separate procedures on the cicatrix. It had been reduced to a hairline scar that was virtually invisible, even when he was tanned. Additional work had been done on his nose and chin. He used scores of names these days, but neither Spencer Grant nor Michael Ackblom was one of them. Among his closest friends in the Resistance, he was known as Phil Richards. Ellie had chosen to keep her first name and adopt Richards as her last. Rocky responded as well to Killer as he had to his previous name. Phil turned his back to the ocean, made his way between the ranks of sunbathers, and entered the lushly landscaped grounds of one of the newer hotels. In sandals, white shorts, and a flamboyant Hawaiian shirt, he resembled countless other tourists. The hotel swimming pool was bigger than a football field and as free-form as any tropical lagoon. Artificial rock perimeter, artificial rock sunning islands in the center, a 2-story waterfall spilling into one palm-shaded end. In a grotto behind the cascading water, the poolside bar could be reached either on foot or by swimmers. It was a Polynesian-style pavilion with plenty of bamboo, dry palm fronds, and conch shells. The cocktail waitresses wore thongs, wraparound skirts made from a bright orchid pattern fabric, and matching bikini tops. Each had a fresh flower pinned in her hair. The Padrakian family, Bob, Jean, and their 8-year-old son Mark, were sitting at a small table near the grotto wall. Bob was drinking rum and coke, Mark was having a root beer, and Jean was nervously shredding a cocktail napkin and chewing on her lower lip. Phil approached the table and startled Jean, to whom he was a stranger, by loudly saying, "Hey, Sally, you look fabulous," and by giving her a hug and a kiss on the cheek. He ruffled Mark's hair. "How you doing, Pete? I'm going to take you snorkeling later. What do you think of that?" Vigorously shaking hands with Bob, he said, "Better watch that gut, buddy, or you're going to wind up looking like Uncle Morty." Then he sat down with them and quietly said, "Pheasants and dragons." A few minutes later, after he had finished a piña colada and surreptitiously studied the other customers in the bar to be sure that none of them was unusually interested in the Padrakians, Phil paid for all their drinks with cash. He walked with them into the hotel, chatting about non-existent mutual relatives. Through the frigid lobby, out under the porte-cochere, into the stifling heat and humidity. As far as he could tell, no one was trailing or watching them. The Padrakians had followed telephone instructions well. They were dressed as sun-worshipping tourists from New Jersey, although Bob was pushing the disguise too far by wearing black loafers and black socks with Bermuda shorts. A sightseeing van with large windows along the sides approached on the hotel entrance drive and stopped at the curb in front of them under the porte-cochere. The current magnetic mat signs on each of its front doors declared Captain Blackbeard's Water Adventures. Under that, above a picture of a grinning pirate, less bold letters explained guided scuba tours, jet ski rentals, water skiing, deep sea fishing. The driver got out and came around the front of the van to open the sliding side door for them. He wore a stylishly wrinkled white linen shirt, lightweight white ducks, and bright pink canvas shoes with green laces. Even with dreadlocks and one silver earring, he managed to look as intellectual and dignified as he had ever been in a three-piece suit or in a police captain's uniform in the days when Phil had served under him in the West Los Angeles division of the LAPD. His ink-black skin seemed even darker and glossier in the tropical heat of Miami than it had been in Los Angeles. The Padrakians climbed into the back of the van, and Phil sat up front with the driver, who was now known to his friends as Ronald, Ron for short, Truman.
"Love the shoes," Phil said. "My daughter's picked them out for me."
"Yeah, but you like them.
Can't lie, they're cool gear."
"You were half dancing the way you came around the van, showing them off." Flashing a grin as he drove away from the hotel, Ron said,
"You white men always envy our moves."
Ron was speaking with a British accent so convincing that Phil could close his eyes and see Big Ben. In the course of losing his Caribbean lilt, Ron had discovered a talent for accents and dialects. He was now their man of a thousand voices.
"I gotta tell you," Bob Padrakian said nervously from the seat behind them, "we're scared out of our wits about this."
"You're all right now," Phil said. He turned around in his seat to smile reassuringly at the three refugees.
"Nobody's following us, unless it's a look down," Ron said, though the Padrakians probably didn't know what he meant. "And that's not very likely."
"I mean," Padrakian said, "we don't even know who the hell you people are."
"We're your friends," Phil assured him.
"In fact, if things work out for you folks anything like the way they've worked out for me and for Ron and his family, then we're going to be the best friends you've ever had." "More than friends, really," Ron said. "Family."
Bob and Jean looked dubious and scared. Mark was young enough to be unconcerned.
"Just sit tight for a little while and don't worry," Phil told them. "Everything'll be explained real soon."
At a huge shopping mall, they parked and went inside. They passed dozens of stores, entered one of the less busy wings, went through a door marked with international symbols for restrooms and telephones, and were in a long service hallway. They passed the phones and the public facilities. A stairway at the end of the corridor led down to one of the mall's big communal shipping rooms, where some smaller shops without exterior truck docks received incoming merchandise. Two of the four roll-up truck bay doors were open, and delivery vehicles were backed up to them.
Three uniformed employees from a store that sold cheese, cured meats, and gourmet foods were rapidly unloading the truck at bay number 4. As they stacked cartons on hand carts and wheeled them to a freight elevator, they showed no interest in Phil, Ron, and the Pedrakians. Many of the boxes were marked perishable, keep refrigerated, and time was of the essence. At the truck in bay number 1, a small model compared with the 18-wheeler in bay 4, the driver appeared from out of the dark, 16-foot-deep cargo hold. As they approached, he jumped down to the floor. The 5 of them climbed inside as though going for a ride in the back of a delivery truck was unremarkable. The driver closed the door after them, and a moment later they were on the road.